We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
I'll throw a curveball at you first. Let's try a quick hypothetical question. If I told you right now that I have with me, I told you I'm Russian. I brought with me, back in the car, two guys. They're waiting outside. Both are 73 kg players. They happen to be in the top 10 of the world. One is Russian. The other is Japanese. And I'll give you $1 million if you beat one of them in judo, in a judo match. Which one do you fight?
Oh, tough question.
A Russian or a Japanese, which one would you face?
I think I'd take my shot against the Russian.
Oh, wow.
And the reason is they're so much more technical. The Russians obviously have great judo, explosive power. Don't get me wrong. I mean, it's a tough decision either way. But yeah, when I look back at my statistics and in which style of player I beat more often, I had more success against Russians than I did against Japanese.
All right. That's the voice of Jimmy Pedro. I'm here at the Pedro Judo Center talking with Jimmy, a legendary judo competitor and coach. He represented the United States at four Olympics, 92, 96, 2000, 2004, winning bronze at two of them. He medaled in three world championships, winning gold in 99. He has coached many, if most elite level American judoka, including Kayla Harrison, Ronda Rousey, Travis Stevens, Rick Hahn, Alex Otiano, Taraji Williams, the Roddy Ferguson, they work together, as many people know, and many others. Four of those people have been on this podcast. So,
nice.
Your first judo coach was your dad, still your judo coach.
Always will be.
Always will be. Can you talk about your relationship with your dad when you first started judo? Did he put a lot of pressure on you to win?
So my dad, for those of you that have ever had the privilege of meeting him, he's unforgettable. When I was a kid, judo was mandatory. There was no such thing as I don't want to go to judo today. It was you're going to judo tonight, and it was every night. You know, we only had practice when I was a little boy, 3 days a week, but I was at the Jojo 5-6 days a week, running around the mats and watching classes and things like that. But my dad was very hard on me as a youngster, pushed me to compete, pushed me to train. He gave me exercise routines to do when I wasn't doing judo. I had to do conditioning off the mat, you know, that he'd run me through circuit training and stuff like that. So yeah, my dad was a very demanding father, but his mentality was that he knew judo would be good for me, not just to become a great athlete, but for the life lessons that I would learn through the sport of judo and what it would do to help me become a better person.
Yeah, build your character.
Yeah, you know, many parents want their kids to eat vegetables because it's good for them and eat healthy because it's what they want. My father wanted me to do judo because of what it could do for me.
And so, I mean, that is the story of a lot of greats in sport, in wrestling, and in judo. So the question for me is, you're a father now, you're a coach now. Do you and did your dad struggle with that balance between, you know, letting your kid do whatever they want and dragging them kicking and screaming to training?
Well, I'm a different father than my dad was, but I also have my kids have to live in different shoes than I had to live in. So my father wasn't an Olympic champion. He wasn't a national hero, and he fell short of making the Olympics himself. So I was almost doing it with him and for him, whereas my kids feel like they're doing it for me. You know, where they every tournament they go to, they have a ton of pressure because the whole world is watching them because they're Jimmy Pedro's son. And you know, there's a lot of parents that can be obnoxious, and when their kid beats my kid, it's the biggest deal in the world. So my kids have to deal with all that pressure that no kid should have to deal with. So I'm a different father. I give my children the choice of what sports to play. Of course, as young individuals, they all did judo. They all competed up until they were teenagers. But at that point, I let them decide what sports they want to play, what they want to do. Right now, I have a son who's ranked number one in the nation in the sport of wrestling as a sophomore in high school. You know, he chose wrestling as his sport. I have a daughter that went on to play hockey and softball, and now she's a freshman in college at Bentley University. Mm-hmm. But I think that the judo training that they did get when they were young helped mold them as individuals and as good people. And so I wanted them to do it for that same reason.
So you think it's possible? Well, certainly it's possible, but do you think that's the path to success? Is it doesn't have to require excessive pressure from the coaches and the parenting in the early years?
Everybody's different. I think everybody is different and responds to that pressure differently. You know, had I been given a choice, I could tell you right now, I probably wouldn't ever have made any Olympic teams, or I wouldn't have excelled in the sport of judo at all, because it's not something I would have pursued. My dad didn't give me the choice, and it wasn't until I was about 15 years old where I started to become a man and I started to really want to do the sport of judo for myself. Right. Up until that point, I was too immature and didn't understand the dynamic of what was going on. And, you know, I felt all that pressure from my father, and I despised going to training sometimes, or, you know, it was difficult. But as 15, 16, I was like, hey, I'm pretty damn good at this thing. And I like winning, you know, and I like being around other athletes, and I get to see the – at that, you know, at 15, 16, you start to travel. You start to go away from home. You're going to camps in Oklahoma or Florida. Or you're going on trips overseas, and it starts to become fun as a teenager, right? Yeah. You get to see the world. So that's when I started doing it for me, and that's when it really became enjoyable.
And so in those years, late teens, how did your relationship evolve with your dad?
Then it really became I was motivated. You know, I was always a self-motivated kid anyway. But really when I was 15 or 16, I turned the corner and I decided that I was given 100% all the time. And my dad truly became not just a father, but I saw him as a great coach, somebody that had a wealth of knowledge, that knew how to train athletes, that knew how to get the most out of his athletes, and that actually exposed me to the world. I think the biggest credit I can give to my father as a coach is that he sent me away to learn from other people. The biggest mistake most coaches make is that they keep their students to themselves, right, and they hold them back from reaching their potential because they're afraid that student's going to go on and learn something special from somebody else,
right,
and no longer give their original coach credit.
And especially as a father, that must be a scary thing to sort of give up your son to somebody else.
Right, but my dad had said, he said, son, technically I've taken you as far as I can take you. And, mm-hmm, and since I never made the Olympic team, I want to surround you with greatness. Yeah. I want you to go see that these other athletes are just people too.
Yeah.
And that they're not these heroes that you put on big pedestals, but they're everyday ordinary people that make mistakes, that fall down, that get back up. And I wanted you to be around them because champions, you know, be around champions to be a champion. See how they act, see how they behave, see how they think, and also learn from them. And my dad sent me to all the best coaches in America at the time, which were Irwin Cohen, who recently passed away, and Patrick Burris, who was on two Olympic teams. And I went to Neil Adams in England, and I learned from Neil, and he sent me to Japan and sent me to Germany and Gunther Neureiter, and I learned from some good coaches in Japan. And I picked up something everywhere I went. My dad said, hey, if I'm going to send you away, don't just train. I want you to learn.
Right.
I want you to bring back a new technique from everywhere you go and show me what it is. And I can tell you that as I gathered all those new techniques and all that new knowledge, to this day, I can tell you who I learned all of the different techniques that I did in my career from, which is amazing, you know?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest mistake I think that most coaches make, is they don't allow their students to flourish and to be exposed to the rest of the world.
Right.
And I give my dad a lot of credit for having the foresight to do that for me.
Right. Is now on a slightly darker side, was there, as a competitor, was there ever a time you considered quitting judo?
Absolutely. Every champion wants to quit. I can tell you numerous times. When I was only 16 years old, I went to the U.S. Open in judo. At the time, it was one of the hardest tournaments in the world, because the whole world loved coming to America to compete. So we had Japanese and we had Russians and we had French and we had Brazilians. And as a young boy, it was a super hard tournament to compete in. And I competed against all the men. Mm-hmm. And at that tournament, I had a great day. I lost to the Eddie Liddy, who took third in the Olympics in 84. And then I battled back and I was fighting for a bronze medal against the guy from Korea. And I scored in the first like 30 seconds. I threw the Korean guy. And he was a man. He was 24 years old, strong as heck, and physical and technical. And I was just this little scrappy, wiry 16-year-old, right? Yeah. But I threw him. I scored right away. And then he just grabbed me and manhandled me across the mat. Just started shaking my gi and snapping my gi. And I ended up getting 3 penalties and losing the fight. My father went nutso on me. He yelled and he screamed at me. So he embarrassed me in front of everybody.
What was your mistake in that match?
That I was being according to my father, I fought afraid.
Yeah.
I was scared to lose, but physically I couldn't match this guy. He was so anyway. Long story short, I went out in the snow, took my gi off, laid down in Colorado Springs in the snow, and just cried. Just fought my heart out. Fought like 8 fights. You know, I lost for a bronze medal at 16 years old in one of the toughest tournaments. And I felt like a failure.
Yeah.
I felt like my dad hated me.
Yeah.
You know, and he embarrassed me in front of everybody. So I wanted to quit.
Yeah.
I had another time. I was in Japan and I had spent 6 weeks training in Japan. And I went to the Kano Cup. And the Kano Cup is one of the best tournaments in the world. And at that tournament, I sucked a lot of weight after being in Japan for six weeks. I sucked a ton of weight and I was all excited to fight. Well, my first round was against Sergei Kuzminyan. Mm-hmm. Kuzminyan was a Russian. Mm-hmm. First match of the tournament, Kuzminyan threw me free pawn. Mm-hmm. I had no idea who he was. I was all pissed off and upset. Kuzminyan then threw Nakamura free pawn.
Yeah.
And then Kuzminyan went on and he won the tournament. He took first.
Right.
My second round was against Nakamura. Mm-hmm. He beat me by pawn. So I went 0-2 in the Kano Cup after being in Japan for 6 weeks, dieting and losing a lot of weight, made all this sacrifice. I remember sitting on the steps at the Budokan, you know, at 19 years old, thinking to myself, I hate this sport. I just want to quit. You know, this stinks.
So how do you find the will? Where do you find – how do you continue? Every champion wants to quit. I love that. That's brilliant. Yeah. Loss is part of that.
The hardest thing, I think the thing that most people don't realize is that they only see champions as winners. They only see the times when they succeed. Right. They don't see those dark days.
Right.
They don't see those days where they struggled or they lost or they failed or the day in training where they got their butts whooped.
Yeah.
Right? Or those tournaments where they just fought miserable. Nobody ever hears about those days. But we all go through it because nobody goes undefeated in their career. It doesn't happen. So really what makes champions is – how do you want to go out? You know, do you want that to be your last competition? Do you want to go out as a loser, as a quitter?
Right.
Or are you going to suck it up, learn from the loss, dig deeper, get better, remotivate yourself, and become a champion? And that, I think that was my mindset my whole career. I wanted to be on the top of the world. I wanted to be top of the podium. Worlds or Olympics, that was my goal. And quite honestly, that same guy, Kuzminyan, you know, he beat me in the 91 Worlds the next year. And then finally in 92, I got him in the finals of the Italian tournament, the Guido Ciani, and I beat him in that tournament. So, you know, perseverance and tenacity, and sometimes it pays off.
Is there something you regret about your early judo years in terms of training, something you wish you would have done differently?
I think early days, no, because, you know, I played a lot of sports as a kid. My dad allowed me. I played, you know, football, Papuaner football. I played baseball as a young kid. I wrestled in high school. I did judo. So I had a good balance to my adolescent years and my childhood, where I got to play a lot of sports and learn a lot of things about teamwork and really found out that the best thing about judo and wrestling and individual sports is that you ultimately decide how good you're going to be.
Right.
You don't have to rely on the rest of your team, or you don't have to worry about having a crappy coach or, you know, being in a bad situation. You get out of it what you put into it. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I regret anything as a youngster other than I wish I could have enjoyed it more as a child. You know, I went undefeated in judo until I was 11 years old. I fought when I was 6. So I fought 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. I didn't lose a match until I was 11 years old, and that was the finals of the national championships. So think about the pressure of going undefeated for all those years.
You're scared of losing.
Right.
Basically.
Right. And having your father, always bump you up to the next weight class or fight the harder person or in the next age category. You're always challenging yourself. Yeah. So to have all that pressure and push the envelope and the threshold, I had anxiety about every tournament I went into up until I was – till I finally lost.
Right. You talk often – you yourself are a graduate of Brown.
Mm-hmm.
You talk often about the value of education. So do you think there's room for life outside of judo for somebody who wants to make the podium at the Olympics?
Absolutely. With unquestionably, I believe that athletes who live a balanced life, who don't put all of their energy into just sport, end up becoming better athletes. Because when you fail in sport, you feel like a complete failure if that's all you do.
Right.
But if you have something else that you're pursuing parallel to the sport, whether it's an education or whether it's a career or whether it's family, if you have something else in your life that you can put your energy to that makes you feel good about yourself, then they kind of balance each other out, right? So if I fail in sport, but I get an A on this exam, I still feel good about myself.
Right.
Or if I do lousy in school, but I just won this tournament, I feel good about myself because I found some reward in something I did. Whereas if all you do is sport and you fail,
then
you have nothing else. You feel like I sacrificed everything I gave, everything for this moment, and it didn't happen. So I think the lows end up being lower.
Right.
And that's why I encourage my athletes to, you know, to either train, you know, teach other students, get involved in some other way. Like they can take pride in their students winning tournaments.
Right.
You know, that's a parallel path. Or, like I said, education or work or something else to provide some sort of enjoyment.
So that's not – you don't think that's a negative distraction to that one singular focus towards the
I think there's certain times where, you know, obviously 6 months before the Olympic Games, it's time to focus and put all your energy into sport. Okay, so when I was at Brown, I took a break from Brown and I focused just on training in judo and the Olympics.
Right.
You know, but I had never really put my life on hold for sport. I had kids. You know, before I won the 99 Worlds, I mean, I had two kids already and one on the way. You know, so I was a father and you know, coming home from a long training trip or competition run and overseas and coming home and seeing your 2 and 3 year olds run up to you and you're like, "Daddy," and you forget about that guy that just whooped your butt in Russia or wherever it was, right?
Yeah.
You know, it brings new perspective to life.
Yeah. So you medaled in 91 at the Worlds and in 2004 at the Olympics and many times in between. So that's at least 13 years of being one of the best judo competitors in the world. So what would you attribute that longevity to for so long being at the top?
Well, like I said, I wanted to be the best in the world. So my motivation was to be world or Olympic champion.
And there's an injury in there too.
There's a bad injury in there. Yeah. Yes. Well, and that also plays into everything happens for a reason and everything plays into what you ultimately become. My injury was pretty devastating.
Can you describe that, by the way, for people that don't know?
I actually was in a tournament in the finals of a Korea, and I got picked up and thrown on my head in that tournament. And really, instead of taking the fall and just losing, stuck my head out, and I came right down on the top of my head. And then my feet went over, and I did a bridge. I didn't think anything of it. I got up, and I finished the fight, and I lost. But then going home on the airplane, I noticed that it got harder and harder to lift my chin up off of my chest. By the time I landed in Boston, the neck and the disc had swollen so much that it was hitting the spinal cord. And so my chin got pinned to my chest. And then I just had radiating, shooting pain down my arm into my hand, and it was numb. And it was like that for quite a while. So obviously I went to the doctors. First MRI, doctor said, "Jimmy, I'm sorry, but you will never do sports again in your life." He said, I hope that someday I can get you to become just a normal functioning human being again.
Wow.
And I remember and I cried. I remember being in the elevator at 23 years old, thinking that my entire career is over. And at the same time, I couldn't sleep because I couldn't lay down in a bed. My chin had to stay here and my arm had to stay here, or else the pain was excruciating. If I lifted my head in any way, I just couldn't move. Well, that whole arm and that chest muscle and tricep shrunk to zero. All the nerve damage was happened on the right side. So I slept many a nights just sitting in a traction unit with a weight over the door in my dorm room. And I would just sit there with my head trying to pull up, and I would try to sleep because it was the only time I could ever get comfortable. Yeah. But it was miserable. And I had about 6 months of living like that.
For how long did you believe this is it, that you're not doing judo ever again?
The entire time I was injured, and the pain wouldn't go away in the arm. It was just like a dull throbbing pain shooting down the arm. And you had no feeling in your hand or your – so I knew it was serious. And I tell you, I – sometimes the only thing I could do was I would drink like 8 or 10 beers to pass out. I couldn't stand the pain. I couldn't move. You know, I didn't sleep in a bed for that whole time. You know, and then even when it started – when it – I got lucky. I just kept taking anti-inflammatories. I kept doing the traction. And I think I just got lucky over time. The nerve regenerated itself. The disc started to go back in. I never had surgery. And I started getting a little bit of range of motion back. And then I was so excited. I went back to the doctor. And I said, "Doc, I know you said I'm never going to do judo again, but like I can move my head now." And the guy was like, "You've made a lot of progress." And, you know, he said, "Okay. Now, still, I don't want you to run. You can't do judo. No wrestling." He said, "But I want you to go back in the weight room."
Yeah.
"And I want you to start retraining that muscle and that those muscles to move again." And I remember the first day on the Nautilus machine, no weight. There was no weight on the thing. I pulled the pin out and my arm was just like this. And I would just straighten it and then I would pull it back and I would straighten it. And I would just keep trying to train my muscles to move.
Yeah.
First time on the bench press, just the bar. I don't remember all these girls in the weight room at Brown and they're all pushing weight. And I remember taking the bar off and I would try to get that out. And I just, it just shook and it took a lot of rehab to get that. And then finally, over time, I got stronger and stronger. And he said, you know, started to train neck muscles and traps and it came back and it took about 9 months to be back strong enough where I could get back on the mat and start doing uchikomis and start to train again.
It's incredible. And then almost 10 years after that, win a right? A bronze at the Olympics. So how is the Jimmy Pedro of 1991 different from the one of 2004? So at the beginning of the dominance to the end of the
I would say that the young Jimmy Pedro was fearless, was raw, talented, just gritty, and you know, got after it. Just tough. Just went after it.
Fast.
not so explosive though, because I cut a lot of weight when I was younger, so I wasn't so explosive in '91. And my best years in the sport of judo were between. 95 and 99 was when I was explosive, technical, super, you know, really strong on the mat, physically real explosive. My judo was real technical. Those were my best years in the sport, 95 to 99. In fact, 95, I look back and I should have been in the finals of the worlds that year. I could have been world champion in 95. I lost to a Korean in the semifinals by a split decision. Yeah. And
this is judo.
It was a split flag decision that I thought I won. And I think the Korean thought I won. In that year, the Japanese who won the worlds 3 months later, I beat him pretty easily in Germany. So thought I should have been world champion 95. And then 2 weeks before the 97 world championships, which I was undefeated like the whole year, winning everything. 2 weeks before I was supposed to go to world championships, I went to a training camp that the coach talked me into going to. And two of the heavyweights, one guy got thrown into my leg and he took my MCL. I had a second degree sprain of my MCL. He just fell into it, but it swelled up. And it was only 2 weeks before I had to step on the mat at the worlds. and that MCL couldn't heal in time. So I didn't actually fight in the 97 World Championships as a result of that. So, but 99, I was 98, 99. I don't think I lost maybe 2-3 times in that whole run, you know, and really it was because I competed so many tournaments right in a row, 1 week after another week after another week, your body gets broken down. But then 2004, you know, I retired after 2000 only because I told my family that, all right, this is the end of my run. I'm supposed to win the Olympics. This will be my last Olympics. It's time to start life. My wife has sacrificed 12 years waiting for me to come home. And when I didn't win in Sydney, I started life. I started working, and I just didn't want to go out as a loser, as somebody who didn't medal in the Olympics. And I just couldn't accept it. So I was inspired at the 2002 Olympic Games, yeah. And I was really inspired by that. And I said, Maria, I want to do this one more time. So she said, of course, I knew this was coming, and by all means, let's do it. And that was the most enjoyable 2 years of my life. From 2002 to 2004, I was in the finals of every single tournament.
Yeah.
Every tournament I made the finals, all the way through, no matter what tournament it was. And I just enjoyed the life of an athlete again. And you can be selfish. You can focus on yourself. You can train. You feel great. You never get that same feeling out of anything else in life as being a winner or a champion or having the crowd roar. And you don't get that from anything else. Yeah. I'm in business and I can do some big deals, but it's still not that same feeling.
Yeah. It's, you know, all on you. All eyes are on you. It's
right.
All up to you.
Right. It's awesome. And so I enjoyed that. And so as 2004 athlete, I was physically strong. I had the
great cardio.
I had great cardio. I knew how I was efficient with my muscles. I knew how to, you know, spend energy. I wasn't as good of a judo player in 2004 as I was in 95 to 99, but good enough to win.
Do you think, to be poetic for a moment, do you think, like you said, with age, athletes lose the fearlessness of youth? That how essential is that? That stupid being brave and stupid in your singular focus on this just drive.
Absolutely. You know, it I think it's a good balance. It depends on how the athlete deals with the pressure. You know, going into the 2000 Olympics, I was 99 world champion. So all eyes were on me to win the gold, right? All the newspapers, all the magazines, everybody was talking about America's first ever gold. So I had all that pressure on me. And it wasn't that the pressure got to me. It's just that first round I had the Korean guy was top five guy in the world, and he was always a tough match for me. So I just wasn't meant to be. But going into 2004, I was old. I had experience, but I wanted it. I was hungry again. I wasn't afraid. I didn't have pressure. I couldn't wait to compete in 2004. You know, so I was older, but I had that hunger. And what happened was ironic with Kayla Harrison. You know, when she was world champion 2010, she tried to repeat in 2011. Well, all you could see it in her training. You could see it in her competition. The pressure of trying to repeat as world champion was so great. She kind of cracked on the, you know, she cracked on the pressure. She felt it similar to what I did in Sydney. You feel the pressure. You're not sure if you're doing enough. You're not sure if you're ready. And probably the best thing that ever could have happened to her in 2011 was to lose and finish third.
Yes.
Because it set her up that she wasn't the top dog going into London. She was one of the favorites, but she wasn't ranked number one. She was number four. Mm-hmm. And she was an underdog. And she wanted to climb back on the top of the podium again. So she was hungry again. Yes. Whereas if she had been a world champion in 2011,
even more,
she would have never won the Olympics in 2012. Never would have happened. So
what now, you don't have to admit this, but have you ever been broken on the mat in competition? For whatever reason, you lost hope or confidence in the match. Has there ever been a guy tough enough to have broken you?
I've never been broken in a judo match, and I've never quit, ever. just not my mentality. I fought some guys that were tough as nails, you know, that I had to fight for my life against, but I never backed down to anybody. I might have got beaten, but I went out fighting.
Never quit.
I never quit ever in a match.
So maybe can you think of anyone in particular who's the toughest guy I've ever faced in competition for you personally?
I mean, I had so many tough fights in judo competition. Yeah. I mean, I had some real matches with Udo Qualmals, the German. He was 2-time world champion, Olympic champion, and Udo and I fought hard, you know, 5-6 times. Those were wars that if it was golden score, we might still be fighting today, you know. And there was a Japanese guy, Nakamura, Yukimasa Nakamura. He was somebody I never beat in my career. I never beat that guy. He beat me in the semis of the junior worlds. He beat me in the semis of the senior worlds, beat me at the Kano Cup. He beat me in the finals of France. Mm-hmm. I remember every loss. So he was just a very skillful, and you know, judo is a lot about matchups. If you don't match up well against somebody, right, then you know, you have a hard time beating them. Absolutely. But he was a guy I had a hard time beating. So, but I never backed down, and I never, you know, nobody ever just ran over me.
So I remember I talked to Taraji Williams, and he said he was really depressed after his Olympic run, I think second. Mm-hmm. What is that life after the Olympics? Were you haunted by the losses? Is there a depression? Like you will never achieve this kind of high. What is that transition into normal life, into the life of a coach?
It's really hard. And I can tell you, having been to 4 Olympics, they were all very different. My first Olympics that I lost, I won 2 matches. I lost my 3rd. But the 3 guys that were on the podium were 3 guys that I had beaten. Yeah. And I'd beaten many times. So I felt as if I should have been there. And sitting in the stands with my father, I remember crying, thinking, I gave up my entire life. I sacrificed all those trainings in the gym and all that time overseas and away from home and missed parties and missed this and missed that. And that's it. Yeah. It's over. Like 3 matches, I'm done. I didn't do anything in the Olympics. I failed. Yeah. I felt like crap. It was depressing. Luckily, I was young enough and stupid enough that, you know, I wanted to try again, you know.
Again, yeah.
Winning in Atlanta was fabulous. You know, winning in America and walking around town and have everybody treat you like a hero and welcome you into their store or their restaurant or their bar or whatever it was and show your medal and take pictures. You were a rock star in Atlanta, and it was awesome. But when you come home, you get tugged in a million directions by a million people that want your time. Yeah. So what ends up happening is you start doing everything for everybody else. Hey, can you show up to this kid's thing and, right, you know, talk at the school, or can you come to this appearance and sign autographs? And you find that your time is all about giving other people your time. Right. And you don't really ultimately enjoy it anymore, because you could see how sometimes stars just feel like they never have a sense
curse of
themselves.
Celebrity, really.
Right.
Yeah.
You never have a sense for yourself or peace for yourself. Right. Well, you never do anything for yourself. It's always about other people. So that becomes hard. But it comes with the, I'll take the win every day of the week over not, right?
Yeah,
so,
of course.
Then Sydney was devastating.
Yeah.
Losing in Sydney was the worst ever. It really was a dark.
And you retired.
And I retired. And so I felt like a failure. And I felt like, you know, 5th place in the Olympic Games for me was a total failure, considering I was supposed to win the Olympics. So that was a hard one to swallow. And that's why I couldn't ever swallow it forever. I needed to fight again. But yeah, I could see how somebody like a Taraji, who didn't medal in the Olympics, who pursued it, you know, as long as he did and made 2 Olympic teams, as great as everybody else sees that feat. As an athlete, when you have your sights set on achieving excellence and you don't, you definitely feel unfulfilled. And you could see that, like I said, in sport, you really don't get that same sense of elation from anything else in life. You know, I ran a marathon, and I ran the Boston Marathon 1 time. And when I got done, people were like, oh my God, that must have felt awesome. I said, no, I couldn't wait to go home. I was tired. You know, I just wanted to lay down and eat.
Yeah.
But wasn't that the greatest feeling in the world? I'm like, no. Would you do it again? I said, no. Why would I do it again? I already did it once.
Yeah.
You know, but most people, for them, it's such a massive accomplishment. For me, it was just, okay, I did it. I'm done. Move on. You know, childbirth, I hear people say childbirth is awesome, and it is. It's different. It's a sense of – but it's a different feeling than what you get from winning. And the only thing that has ever come close to me doing it was when Kayla won.
Yeah.
It was being a part of something, and I believe that was destiny, that she came here for a specific purpose. Some higher being stuck her in this dojo. And the reason why I didn't win in Sydney is because that girl was supposed to win in London. Yeah. And we were supposed to help her on that journey, my father and myself. That we were supposed to be a part of that. Yeah. And that was the magic moment.
It's an amazing chain of events that it feels like it leads up to,
And to me, I believe in that destiny, and I believe in karma and good things. So,
and repeat in 2016.
Let's hope. It's setting up nicely.
So in the United States, a country where judo has struggled to gain ground over the years, over wrestling and jiu-jitsu, compared to other nations in the world, you have produced almost all, if not all, of the U.S. medalists at Worlds and Olympics in the last two decades. What is your secret? What is the system that you follow? So let's say how do you take a 6-year-old, maybe not a 6-year-old, but let's say a 6-year-old with an interest in judo and give them a shot at the Olympics medal stand by the time they're 22? What is the process you follow to make so many champions?
Well, first and foremost, there is a system, and that's the thing that most other places in America don't have. And that's really the problem with the entire USA judo, is that we don't have a system to produce high level athletes. We've done it here in Boston, and I was part of this elite under 23 program where we took the 20 most talented kids in the country, and of that crop came Marty Malloy, Travis Stevens, Kayla Harrison, Nick Del Popolo. They were part of that U23 program that I was a part of for 6 years. So that was also my system. And really, it's obviously, to be great, you got to be willing to work, right? You have to be willing to put in the hours, and you got to be willing to take the punishment. So it's a mentality. Number one, it's a championship mindset you have to have. Second, you got to know how to train. And we believe in a system of conditioning. Mm-hmm. We believe in grip fighting. We believe in Nawaza, and we're big into strategy. Mm-hmm. So we know that we cannot beat the Russians, we cannot beat the French, we cannot beat the Brazilians, we cannot beat the Japanese by doing more judo than they do, because it's impossible.
Yeah.
Right. We can't beat them with judo because they have numbers. Way more people to train with, right? Way more opportunity. So we have to beat them with physicality, technical, strategy, gripping, Nawaza, conditioning, toughness, in a mindset that we're going to win. And this is how we're going to win. And you got to get your students to believe in that system that, okay, we're doing all. And the way we train very intense. When I go to Russia or Japan, two different things. Russia is a lot of drilling, mm-hmm. a lot of technique, a lot of free motion and free feel, and not a lot of randori, right? Mm-hmm. When you go to Japan, it's the opposite. It's all randori.
Really? Randori heavy. Wow.
They all do they do 15 rounds of randori a day in Japan. It's insane. In Russia, they're lucky if they do 15 in a month, right? It's because it's very technical. Yeah. But two different schools of thought. We do really intense, focused training here. And we're smart with the periodization of our athletes.
Yeah, so you've mentioned that you believe in the idea of, peaking.
Peak performance.
So what is it essential to cycle?
It is.
Why can't you be at your 100% year-round?
Because
– Is it a mental aspect?
Physically you can't be, and mentally you can't be. You need to have times of relaxation, and you need to have times of focused training. And I tried to teach this just recently to my 16-year-old boy who's trying to be the best in wrestling. I said, mm-hmm. son, you can't go 365 days a year banging your head against the wall and not enjoying life, because in the end, you'll be like this. You'll be great, and you'll be here, but you'll never have that performance of a lifetime that you need to have. And you need to have this. You need to have the time where you're not at this level, but you're at this level. Mm-hmm. Your body needs time to heal. Your muscles need time to heal and rest. Your mind needs time to heal and rest in order to have. Otherwise, it gets used to being right here all the time in this zone. We want to have a zone where it's above that, and that's what's Olympic champion. That's what world champion is.
Right.
You know. But in order to have that, you got to let your body come down so that it can build from somewhere.
Right.
So you see that a lot. Boxers are actually pretty good at that. Yes. I mean, they take it to an extreme where they get so fat and so out of shape. Then it's their training camp for 12 weeks or 16 weeks, right?
Yeah.
But that's the idea, is that I'm not training now. I'm relaxing. I'm having fun so that I can focus when it's time to focus and get real serious about this, and I can push my body to limits that I otherwise wouldn't. And that's what we believe in.
You've mentioned your father, Jim Pager Sr., is a big part of the club. What role does he play as part of the system?
He's a huge part of the system. You ask any of the athletes, he gives his time. I work full time. I have four children. So judo is never going to make me rich.
Yes.
Well. Right? So my life as a judoka has helped me become pretty wealthy because of being involved in martial arts. So I'm able to – I just started a brand new mat company, the Fuji Mat Company. Mm-hmm. Just started that. I've been involved in selling Fuji and Hadashida sports goods for the last year or so. So I've been able to make my life through martial arts and judo, but the sport of judo is not what puts food on my kids' table.
Right.
So in order for these athletes to become great, they need to train more than once a day. So my dad is down here with every single morning. He runs a morning technical training session for all of our elite guys.
Yeah. Can you actually describe, at least in broad strokes, what a weekly program looks like for an elite level judoka?
Sure. So our athletes train Monday morning. They train here judo, technical session. It's about an hour to an hour and 15 minutes of technical training.
What do you mean by technical training? So it's like drilling, throws, not randori?
Sometimes. Depends on how many bodies we have and depends on who's in town training.
Right.
But for the most part, it's mostly drills, gripping drills, newaza drills, throwing drills, three-man uchikomis, speed drills, sprints in the morning at the end of practice, some conditioning, but they're training for an hour to an hour and 15 minutes every morning.
Right.
When they leave here, they then go to a professional strength coach. Some of them go to Mike Boyle's strength and conditioning in Woburn. Some of them go to the place I went at with Paul Soucy, one-to-one strength training in North Andover. But after they work out here, they have a break, they go eat. Then mid-afternoon, they're at a strength training place. Judo-specific strength training. It's not power lifting. Okay. It's some type of circuit training. It depends on what type of time of year it is.
Right.
And what phase of training we're in, what type of lifting they're doing.
Yeah.
So it depends. But they're doing something focused for, again, between an hour and a half, you know, with stretching and everything else built in, an hour and a half of afternoon. Then they come back at night and they'll train randori at night. We do another hour and a half randori session at night. So they're minimally doing three trainings almost every day.
Yes.
They go Monday like that, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. They have the morning off. So they just do weight training and judo. And then Friday morning only they train.
Okay. And then Saturday, Sunday off.
Saturday depends on the weightlifting schedule they're on. Sometimes, like a Friday, they only have one training. And Saturday, they normally have one training, a weight training. But they get Saturday night off and Sunday off.
Beautiful. Okay.
Unless we're fighting in a tournament, then they have to go to the tournament on the weekend.
What has been the biggest challenge for you in preparing for the 2016 Olympics in Rio, preparing the team?
For me personally, it's been balancing family with team. My wife's been at this for a long time, right? So she's been helping since 1992. She's been living with me going to the Olympics. So after the 2012 Olympics, it really took a hard toll on my family because I had to travel so much. So I took a break after 2012 and I've been home a lot and I've been focusing on the family. I have a daughter that's six. I have three teenagers that give mom hell at home when I'm away. So I've been really focusing on family. So that's why it's been hard for me to balance, because I love judo. I love the sport. I love helping the athletes. I love being in the game. And I genuinely feel that the athletes benefit with having me in their chair and with them, and it inspires them, and it, I think it gives them a lot of confidence. But so that's been the challenge for me, is balancing both. But now that the Olympics is ramping up again here, and we're just about to turn 2015, there's going to be a lot more traveling coming with the team. And but my dad's picked up. I put my dad in that role, you know, because the best two athletes in our country are Kayla Harrison and Travis Stevens. Mm-hmm. So they're from our territory. They're from our home club. So my dad is their coach, and I'm their coach. So if they can't have me, they have the next best thing, and that's right. My dad, you know.
What is the most painful moment you remember, maybe one that stands out as a coach?
Watching Travis Stevens lose at the semifinal match at the Olympic Games, unquestionably as a coach, was the most painful moment I've ever been involved in. Because I see how hard the boy works. I see how much he wants it. I see how much he sacrifices. He's a kid who, he doesn't drink alcohol. He's straight as an arrow.
Yeah.
You know, and when I gave you that schedule of 3 times a day training, he's out there right now doing jujitsu. Yeah. So he trains 4 to 5 times a day. Like, he's a mat rat.
Yeah.
You know, he wants it.
And when he's hurt, he pushes through.
Yeah. I mean, he's a incredible tough kid. Dude. So I felt really bad for him, because you don't really get those moments back in life where you're in the semifinals of the Olympic Games. In fact, he may never get that moment back. Right. I hope he does. But that was flip of a coin who wins the fight. Yeah. And if it goes his way, he's a silver medalist or a gold medalist in the Olympics.
Yeah.
You know? So that was really painful. And I watched him cry on the sideline for an hour after that. And then he had to fight for bronze. And normally, 9 times out of 10, he'll beat that Canadian. You know, he beat the boy before the Olympics many times. It just, he had physically drained his body of all emotion.
Yeah.
He had nothing left for the bronze fight. So.
So you're a coach now, but you're also and forever a judoka. So how's the Jimmy Pedro of today different from the guy who won bronze in 2004 in terms of how's your judo developed? How you think, technically, how you think about judo, how you approach judo, how you teach judo?
Well, I take a lot of what I learned in my career and I pass it on to my students. I really had nobody that gave that to me.
Right.
So there's a mental side of this game that I learned, and I trained my mind. I visualized success myself. I had some good self-talk that I did with myself all the time. I've passed all of that on to my students, how to use their mind to achieve success, how to see it, how to believe it. Even before they do it, they have to believe it and they have to see it. And I'm a firm believer that if you create that pathway in your mind enough times, what happens is when the moment comes for it to happen, your body thinks it's been there before and that's where it's supposed to go. Yeah. So it'll go.
Yeah.
And most people, they never see it happen. They only think, oh, I hope I want to be an Olympic champion someday. But they never really see it, believe it, experience it before it happens. And therefore, it never will. Right. Because they don't think it's possible.
Yes.
So
Kayla talked about that is something you taught her, and then she just felt like at the Olympics, she felt like it's almost like you're an autopilot. It's an obvious fact that she's getting the gold. She's almost walking through the
right.
through the steps that she's visualized a million times.
So I was able to pass that on. And you know, they say sports is like 90% mental, right? I mean, because if it was just training, everybody would train 365 days a year. Right? 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's it. It's just whoever trains the most. But it's not. We all do the physical stuff. But not everybody does that mental stuff. And I really, as a coach, focus on that side of the game, as well as the strategy and looking at videos and studying how to beat this opponent and what our objectives are in this match. And I think that also, rather than just walk out blindly and just fight, you got to have a strategy going in.
Right.
So I think taking that professional approach to the game, you know, and with our system, if you look at the number of people we have in this dojo in terms of elite athletes and the number of bodies we have to train with, we got to be doing something right, right? Right? Because
right.
we're competing with Japan and Russia and France and everywhere else right. with what we have, and we don't have very much money either.
Right.
So we're up against all odds, yet we're still getting it done.
Yeah.
So I'd say how is it different? I think I'm a little bit more cerebral as a coach than I was as an athlete, because I had to learn a lot of it on my own when I was a player.
So last topic, one that gets a lot of talk, but in the last half decade, the IJF, the International Judo Federation, has made a lot of rule changes, starting from banning leg grabs. Can you summarize the rules, the rule changes, and say whether you think they have had an overall positive or negative effect on judo?
The IJF's goal was to differentiate judo from wrestling.
From wrestling. Okay.
They really wanted to differentiate the two sports so that in case the Olympic Committee said, you know what, we need to get rid of another sport. Which sport are we going to get rid of? Well, wrestling and judo are kind of the same. They're very similar. Why don't we just get rid of one of them?
Right.
So they really wanted to differentiate itself from wrestling.
That was before they
before
threatened
they almost
wrestling.
Chucked wrestling, right. So that was one reason. Second is they tried to make it a little bit more fan-friendly, right? So, man, how much time is spent gripping, you know, and ripping and gripping? So they've taken a lot of the gripping rules out of the game, and you're not allowed to break grips so many times anymore. And they thought that was a boring element of judo. But the reality of the situation is that judo is never going to be a fan-friendly live sport. Right. It just isn't. It's never going to be. Right. And if you're not a judoka and you don't have an interest in who's fighting, it's boring. Judo can be very spectacular if you create a story behind it and you do a one-hour show where you're only showing highlights of and behind the scenes and who is this athlete and get to know him and get the people to know who he is and then show his series of fights and show his throws or submissions and pump him up to watch the final. And then when the final happens, just show the best clips of the final and have some commentary going about what's going on. You know, then it can be a good sport, but it'll never be a good live sport because it's very boring, and it always will be, no matter what rules you put in. I love wrestling, but wrestling, if you don't know who is wrestling, it's boring.
Yeah,
you don't, and it's and same
especially
with
the elite level.
Same with American football, though. If you truly, all the Europeans say football is so boring. You start, you stop, you start, you stop. I don't get it, and because they don't have an interest in any team that's they don't care who wins.
Right.
They're not from New England rooting for the Patriots, you know. Say, when we watch soccer as Americans, it's boring. We're not rooting for
that's
any
really
team.
So it's really the story that people fall in love with in football. And
or
anything.
It's the team.
Like, so, yeah, they know the players. They know they have a close connection with the people.
You got to be into the game
to
enjoy it. So no fan who has never done judo is ever going to enjoy watching judo unless it's a highlight reel and they're like, oh, geez, oh.
Yeah.
And they see the – cool stuff going on. So I think all the rule changes are for naught. I don't think they're not going to affect the popularity of the sport. Unquestionably, they're not going to affect. I go to all of these big Grand Slam tournaments in Abu Dhabi and there's nobody in the stands.
Right.
You know, you go to all these tournaments and there's nobody watching.
Right.
Everybody's watching online, but nobody's watching. Right. So I think the rule changes, to be honest with you, I think it's gotten more towards sport. It's less towards – if you think about what judo was founded on, it was founded on sport, the Olympic sport. It was founded on self-defense, right, as an element of the sport. Judo has no self-defense element whatsoever anymore.
Right.
It's all about sport.
Right.
No dojos really teach self-defense element of judo. And what are leg grabs? Really, leg grabs are self-defense. If some guy attacks me with his legs, I'm grabbing his leg.
Right,
so they've taken that out of it. And even as a judo player who's in the sport, some guy who's very 6'1" and I'm 5'5", he's got really long legs. So if he comes in high, I should be able to grab it.
Right.
So you're taking that part of the sport. So I disagree with that. And then the kata, you know, the prearranged movements. Nobody does that anymore, really. Anyway, you know. Yeah. So judo's lost a lot of its. It's basically come down to just being an Olympic sport these days, which is impractical. For the masses, because the masses are never going to compete in the sport. It's too dangerous. It's too physical. So if you – like jiu-jitsu succeeded because it's taken it to a safe place. It's taken it to the ground. Nobody's tumbling and falling and doing 360s. And they're rolling.
Yeah.
They're getting a good workout. They're learning some self-defense.
Yeah.
Right?
You could be 80 years old and
– But it's safe.
Yeah.
Right. But that's okay. That's what – if you want to make the sport popular – everybody has to be able to do it.
Yeah.
And right now, judo has become a sport that only the young can do. That's why I think it's failing.
The question is, judo got into the Olympics in 1964. That's exactly 50 years ago. So martial arts in general have gone a long way in the last 50 years.
Sure.
Thanks to the Olympics. And even, I think, very importantly, thanks to mixed martial arts, where they kind of put like sumo and karate and all of these things together. And you realize that, you know, the grappling arts have a lot to contribute to. This is a really effective art, an exciting art. So where do you think judo will be? This is a weird question, but 50 years from now. So do you think there's something timeless in terms of value in the sport of judo? Oh.
Judo's trying to become more professional, right? But it's also becoming a very expensive sport. So what I see happening over the course of time is all of the big programs are going to continue to be big in the sport of judo because they're invested.
Across the world.
Yes. Only the big programs, Paris. Though.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen is, like, right now they have a cadet circuit. So kids 14 to 18 years old, they can get on a world ranking list, and there's a cadet circuit that they compete against. Yes. Other cadets. Then there's a junior circuit, you know, that's up to 21 years old, and all these juniors have world rankings, and there's a junior competitions all over the world to develop those athletes. Right. And then there's a senior circuit. The problem is the big countries like a Japan and a Brazil and a France and a Russia and a lot of the European countries, they have the budgets and they're investing in their youth to ultimately run from cadet to junior to senior. So they're going to continue to flourish as countries and get stronger and invest more money and grow. All of the other countries, including America, who don't have money, we don't invest any money right now at all in our junior program.
Right.
Not even forget our cadets. Our cadets, their parents have to pay U.S. judo just to have their kids do judo. But we invest nothing in our juniors because we don't have the budget for it. So all we focus on is the elite side, and it's becoming more and more expensive to fund these athletes to qualify for the Olympics.
Right.
As soon as you shut off that opportunity for us to qualify for the Olympics, judo's gone in America. It'll be non-existent.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and that's the direction we're headed. We have less elite athletes today in America than we did 4 years ago, than we did 8 years ago, than we did back in the 70s. Yeah. There's less elite players today than there was then. So judo continues to shrink. The more expensive it becomes, I don't even see countries like Peru and a lot of the South American countries, Argentina, Venezuela, they used to have good full teams of athletes. Nowadays, the number of athletes that are competing at the Worlds and Olympics, they're less and less and less and less. They have less money to do it. They have no budgets. They're going to disappear. So what judo is going to become, it's going to become a much smaller sport in terms of number of countries that participate. Because there's not going to be any programs in any of those other countries that can compete with the rest of the world. And so 50 years from now, I don't think you'll see anybody from
the United States.
Yeah, I'd be.
There always could be some renegade club from Boston that proves everybody wrong.
I'm going to tell you, mark my words right now, that if there isn't a drastic change in this country,
from funding from
that
from
come the 2020 Olympic game. You'll be lucky to see two Americans on that team. Two. We get one guaranteed because the IJF will give you one.
Right.
So, but you'll be lucky to see two in Tokyo, the direction we're headed. Because you're going to lose Travis. You're going to lose Marty. You're going to lose Kayla. You're going to lose Nick.
Yeah.
You're going to lose all your best athletes right now. And I really don't see the pipeline coming up.
I hope that doesn't come to reality, but
me either.
On that dark note, people can find you on jimmypedro.com, on Facebook. Where else?
I'm a vice president and a partner in Fuji Sports and the Fuji Mat Company. So we love your business and love your support. We We deck out clubs with complete outfitting their gyms with mats and wall pads and all kinds of gear. And then obviously the gi and gear, we do custom uniforms for gis and shorts and rash guards and stuff for clubs at fujisports.com.
That's the only gi I own is Fuji gis. Like I'm moving to California now. I have a closet full of, you know, like 20 gis. I have to figure out what to do with them.
Before we end, yes. I'd like to comment, Lex, that I've done considerable amount of interviews in my day and through the years. I will say that this is the most well-thought-out, comprehensive, intelligent, thought-provoking questions that I've ever been asked in my career.
Thanks. I appreciate that. So I won't – since you said that, I will not hold your comment in the beginning about you choosing the Russian against you. So thank you very much for the warm welcome. It's been fun. Next time I'll come with my gi on.
Awesome. You're welcome. Thanks anytime, so much, brother.